Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. Following the collapse of the Republican Senate's latest effort to repeal Obamacare, we'll begin with another less publicized effort by Republican senators to jam through unpopular legislation. This time a vote to kill a new ban by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau on banks and credit card companies requiring customers to give up their right to sue and participate in class action suits, forcing them instead into corporate-friendly closed-door arbitration. Amanda Werner, the arbitration campaign manager with Americans for Financial Reform and Public Citizen, joins us to discuss how this brazen stealth attempt to cripple the CFPB that comes on the heels of exposés of widespread consumer fraud by Wells Fargo, who ripped off customers, and corporate negligence by Equifax, who have exposed the personal data of millions to cyber criminals. In both cases, these corporate miscreants have used arbitration clauses buried in the fine print to deny consumers access to the courts for restitution. Then we'll examine the humanitarian disaster that Puerto Rico is enduring following the devastation from two hurricanes that have left the island's 3.5 million American citizens without electricity and water. An historian of Latin America and the Caribbean, Luis Martinez Fernandez, a professor of history at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, which has one of the world's highest concentrations of Puerto Ricans, joins us. We'll discuss Trump's belated attention to the island's plight after days of distracting the nation with a ginned-up controversy over football players kneeling during the national anthem. But today, following a series of insensitive tweets about bad infrastructure and too much Wall Street debt, at a White House press conference, Trump repeatedly congratulated himself on his handling of the crisis in Puerto Rico. Then finally, we'll assess the impact of Monday's non-binding independence referendum by the Kurdish regional government, which has provoked threats from Turkey and rebukes from the Iraqi government in Baghdad. An internationally recognized expert on the Kurds, Edmund Garib, the author of The Kurdish Question in Iraq and the Kurdish Nationalist Movement, joins us to discuss the unusual nature of Iraqi soldiers joining with Turkish troops for military exercises near the border with Iraqi Kurdistan. And joining us now is Amanda Werner, who is the arbitration campaign manager with Americans for Financial Reform and Public Citizen, where she advocates strong consumer protection regulations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amanda Werner.
Thank you for having me.
And it does appear to be pretty mendacious that the Republicans in the Senate have been quietly, stealthily working on repealing important sections of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It's always been a target, by the way, the CFPB, of the Republicans. But to what extent have they been using this health care bill as a kind of screen? Because now that they're tabling or giving up on the latest attempt to repeal Obamacare, does that mean their attention is immediately going to switch to gutting the CFPB?
Yes, unfortunately, that appears to be their plan. It looks like failing to repeal important health care protections, they've decided to take away our right to hold companies accountable in court. So essentially what they've done is they've started laying the groundwork for a repeal of a very important consumer protection that we actually just got a couple months ago. Toward the end of July, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau issued its rule to restrict forced arbitration in consumer financial contracts. And basically what that means is pretty well illustrated by the recent Equifax data breach. As folks probably saw, when Equifax announced its data breach and it created this website that would help folks protect their identity and monitor their credit, it forced people to agree to arbitrate their claims in a private proceeding with Equifax instead of being able to join a class action in court. And people were rightly outraged about that. A lot of people spoke out. And luckily, thanks to intense public pressure over a number of days, Equifax walked that back and said that they would not stop people from joining class actions about the data breach. But what people don't know often is that most companies, especially big banks and payday lenders, use these arbitration clauses on a regular basis to keep us from joining class actions against them. So we've seen this play out similarly with Wells Fargo's fake account scandal and other big banks trying to use these clauses to basically get away with breaking the law.
So it's pretty brazen, isn't it, to be doing this at a time when the public are aware of the outrageous behavior of Wells Fargo, for which I think they've suffered at the consumer level, But also Equifax is still an ongoing story, and the idea that they sort of con people into going to a website that they felt they needed to go to find out what had happened to their personal data, and in doing so, they were conned into signing away their rights.
Exactly, yeah, and it's definitely very nefarious that Republicans are trying to push this through at this political moment. You know, I think people are rightly fatigued. We've been fighting healthcare all year long, you know, trying to keep our right to be healthy and get treated when we get sick. So I think a lot of activists are getting, you know, pretty exhausted at this point from fighting future battles. So they've really been able to sneak this one through. And unfortunately, the timing is, you know, even worse, because just next week, next Tuesday and Wednesday, the CEOs of Wells Fargo and the CEO of Equifax, who just resigned this morning, are going to be testifying to the Senate Banking Committee. And essentially the committee's job is, you know, try to get to the bottom of these scandals, figure out what happened, what the company should be held accountable for. And so the fact that the Senate is trying to essentially hand these CEOs a get-out-of-jail-free card in the form of repealing the CFPB rule before we even know the extent of their wrongdoing is really outrageous.
Well, this bill, though, has already been passed in the House, and it's not, as far as I can tell, it's not an absolute slam dunk for the Republicans in the Senate, although they only have to get to the 50-vote threshold. Apparently, Lindsey Graham has already said that he's against it, which is a little odd given that his name is on the Graham-Cassidy bill that they've just tried to push through to repeal Obamacare for the umpteenth time. But then there's Senator John Kennedy, Republican Louisiana. He's apparently sitting on the fence. And Lisa Murkowski, Rob Portman, and perhaps Susan Collins. Who knows? So McConnell is going to take a vote. Do you know when? Because he may not have the votes at this point.
We certainly hope he doesn't. I mean, in addition to the folks that you named, there are a number of Republicans, almost 20 Republicans, who are not co-sponsors on the bill right now. So their votes are not guaranteed either way. You know, honestly, I would hope that folks that co-sponsored this bill when it was first introduced might also think about backing off now that we've seen so much activity around Equifax and Wells Fargo. But you know, I think what we're hearing right now is that right after healthcare falls apart, which ended up being just, you know, a couple hours ago, that they would try to push this. So we're expecting a vote potentially as early as tomorrow, and quite likely later in the week. We certainly hope that McConnell end up not having the votes. I mean, from our perspective, this should not be complicated at all. I think anyone who wants to look an Equifax data breach victim in the eye should be voting against this legislation. But, you know, it's gonna remain to be seen. I think we're going to need to see the level of public outrage that we saw around Equifax really harnessed to fight against this repeal of the rule. And by the way, for any folks that want to do activism around this, the bill number is SJ Res 47. So you can tell them that you oppose that, or you can tell them that you support the CFPB arbitration rule.
SJ Res 47?
Yes.
So, by the way, the CEO of Equifax has just resigned. He's getting an $18 million golden parachute. So we shouldn't feel too sorry for him. And it's pretty extraordinary that they were apparently that lax with this incredibly important information, which is now out there on the dark web. I don't know whether has there been any evidence so far of citizens losing their life savings and et cetera as a result of being scammed because this data is now available. Have you heard anything in that regard?
You know, I haven't heard too many specific stories yet. I honestly think that, you know, right now, if I were a scammer, I would kind of be sitting on this information. You know, I'd be saving it to my hard drive, but not necessarily acting on it, because I do think there's a high alert at the moment. But the unfortunate thing about the Equifax data breach is, you know, this is not like a password that you can change. This is your social security number, your birth date. These are things that are going to put you at risk for the rest of your life if someone else has their hands on them. So I haven't seen any big stories like that, but I imagine this is something that's going to be affecting people for many, many years to come. And frankly, you know, the CFPB arbitration rule is an important protection against things like this. It allows us to join together against big financial giants like Equifax to hold them accountable. But at the end of the day, when we're talking about this data breach in particular, we not only need those kind of protections that we can enforce ourselves, we also need Congress to step in and do something bigger. This is something that affects 143 million people. We really need our lawmakers to stand up and do something more comprehensive to make sure that we can recover from this.
Well, as I mentioned, this it's passed in the House. If the Senate passes it tomorrow, is your guess, there's not a lot of time for people to weigh in and let the senators know that this is pretty outrageous, rewarding these people who've done so much damage to their customers, Equifax and Wells Fargo in particular. But on top of that, of course, there's no question that Donald Trump will sign this if it passes, right? I mean, Donald Trump,
absolutely,
he has a history. His companies, whether it's the real estate or the wine or the golf clubs or you name it, the hotels, they all require their employees to sign away their rights in terms of the very issue that we're talking about here with the CFPB.
Yes, yes. Unfortunately, we do have many instances of President Trump using this in his various businesses, like you said, in the employment arena. So what also folks tend to not know is about half of all workers in the U.S. are bound by these forced arbitration clauses in their employment, meaning that they can't sue their employers for breaking the law. So we're talking about, you know, instances of discrimination, not just kind of civil suits like sexual harassment. This covers any claim that you would have against your employer. You essentially have to go to a private proceeding that is secret where your employer gets to choose the firm that decides the case. And so, yeah, there's no question, I think, that President Trump will support this and sign it into law if it does pass. Unfortunately, I think the reason we're seeing so much energy behind it, even though the vast majority of Americans, I think our latest poll of 95% of people support the right to a day in court, the reason Congress is pushing it regardless is because they are getting so many donations from the financial industry, which is really behind this. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the American Bankers Association, this is their donors that are pushing for this. They know that the American people don't want it. And so we need to continue raising that decibel level and just making sure that they know not only do we not want this, but we are watching them and we are going to hold them accountable just like we did with health care.
So is there data in on what happens with these forced arbitration clauses, Amanda? Because it's been going on for some time, and it's clearly something that corporations favor. And the idea that the company that's being litigated against can choose which arbitration company they use is in itself troubling. But my understanding is that so far on the record, it seems that these arbitration boards, which often are lawyers and et cetera, retired perhaps. I'm sure exactly you can fill us in on that. But is the record so far pretty clear that the majority of cases they find in favor of the corporation over the individual?
Yes. So as part of their rulemaking effort, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau actually spent over 3 years studying forced arbitration in consumer contracts. They looked at basically all of the data that was publicly available. It's the most comprehensive study we've ever seen on arbitration. And what they found is that 93% of the time, arbitrators grant relief to the companies. On the flip side of that, when a consumer has a claim, they tend to win only 9% of the time. So it is vastly weighted against consumers. And in fact, what they also found is that every year, just 16 consumers get any sort of cash relief through arbitration. So not only do people lose most of the time, but so many people are dissuaded from even bringing an arbitration claim because it's so confusing to navigate and costly and often just doesn't make sense for the type of claims that we see in this area. So few people bring it that only 16 people are successful every year anyway. Actually, just a month or so ago, the Economic Policy Institute went back and looked at the CFPB study and just ran the numbers a little bit differently, because we've been hearing these talking points from the industry lobbyists claiming that, you know, when consumers win in arbitration, they win so much money, and they try to tout how much money people win. But what they don't tell you is that very few consumers ever actually win. And so the Economic Policy Institute went back and ran the numbers and just tried to find, you know, regardless of whether the consumer wins, what is the average outcome in arbitration? And what they found is that in most cases, the average consumer is ordered to pay $7,725 to their bank or lender. So you have some small number of claims where consumers win and they get some level of relief, but the vast majority, the consumer actually ends up ordered to pay the bank, which is really outrageous and I think shows the level of bias that we see in these arbitration firms because, you know, frankly, they work for the company. They don't work for us at the end of the day. They're going to see us one time where they're going to, you know, maybe be dealing with Wells Fargo all year.
Well, but this isn't this the result, though, of a 2011 Supreme Court decision that allowing these forced arbitration practices? In other words, would it take a Supreme Court ruling to undo it?
No, luckily it wouldn't. So basically how we got here is there was this 5-4 Supreme Court decision in 2011 that said that companies can use forced arbitration clauses to block class actions. So that is how we kind of came into this moment. But pretty much in response to that decision, as part of the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation where the CFPB was created, Congress specifically gave the CFPB authority to restrict forced arbitration and do this study that it ended up doing. And so, you know, basically the Supreme Court said that under existing law, this was the way they interpreted it, but the Congress has the ability to carve out an exception there. And so that's what they did in Dodd-Frank by giving the CFPB authority here. So it doesn't conflict at all with previous decisions because they were specifically empowered by Congress. So the good thing is if the Senate doesn't interfere with this rule by specifically trying to roll it back, then we will actually have these rights. They will be enforceable. And really, right now, we do have these rights. Congress is trying to take the exceptional move of trying to take those rights away from us after they've already been granted. So hopefully we can fend this off and continue to be able to, you know, hold companies accountable.
But the way to fend it off is to shame these people, right? The shame, and I'm not sure how in some cases you can shame the shameless, but it does look as though Mitch McConnell is pulling out all the stops. Apparently, they're trying to get the appointed senator that took Jeff Sessions' seat, Luther Strange, and now he's in the middle of an election today in Alabama, but they want him to vote in person. He's somewhat preoccupied, obviously, and they also apparently are trying to get Republican Senator John McCain, who's also, been indisposed with cancer surgery. So it does look as if they're trying to pull out all the stops and push this through, right? So there's not a lot of time, by the sound of it, to weigh in and, as I say, try to shame these Republican senators into supporting the interests of the American people over the corporations that fund their campaigns.
Yeah, they are certainly trying to pull out all the stops. We've seen them try to block this rule for a long time now. You know, before the rule was final, they were trying to strip the CFPB of authority to issue it in the first place. So this isn't the first time we've been fighting them in Congress. The real difference here is that this is the last time they can do this. Once they actually have until November 6th under the Congressional Review Act, which is the obscure law that they're using to repeal, they have till November 6th to do this. So now we're up against the deadline, and they know that it's their last shot. The good news is, in the past, when they have tried to do something about this rule and tried to take away our right to sue companies, public outrage has stopped them in their tracks every time. So we really just need to harness that level of energy just this one last time between now and hopefully November 6th, if we can block the vote this week. But then we should be in, you know, a much more secure place. The rule will be final. We will, you know, have our rights back. But I will definitely implore folks, we need as much public outrage as possible. We need public shaming, just like you said. And I think the really outrageous thing is, even if they decide to vote to repeal the rule down the line, we need to hear from the CEO of Wells Fargo. We need to hear from the CEO of Equifax and figure out what the solution is going to be there. If it's not going to be, you know, private enforcement through class actions, then Congress has to give us something else. They can't just leave us with absolutely no power to hold these companies accountable. So I encourage folks to make a lot of calls, send a lot of emails, really be loud about this. You know, as you're calling about healthcare or anything else you care about, include this as well. Tell them that you need your right to a day in court. It's in the Seventh Amendment of the Constitution, and particularly with the kind of corporate misbehavior we've seen in the last few months, this right is more important now than ever.
Well, specifically, wouldn't it make sense for listeners to weigh in on Senator Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Senator Jack Kennedy, and I guess Lindsey Graham's already said that he's not going to vote for it. They're the key votes, aren't they?
You know, we're hearing different things. I think definitely some people are focusing on those folks. I think it's really important, though, for as many Republicans as possible to hear from their constituents. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, would, you know, urge people in general to call their own senators or reach out to their friends in states with Republican senators if you're from a blue state. But in general, I actually don't think it's up to just those votes. What we've heard is there's actually more opposition in the Senate than we would expect, not because people necessarily support the CFPB rule, but because, frankly, they don't want to be forced to vote on something so unpopular at this point in time when people are paying so much attention. So I don't think it's just to those kind of, you know, Republicans who stuck their necks out before. I think a lot of Republicans don't want to take this vote, and the more they are hearing from constituents pushing them on that, the better. So I would say everyone should call and make the case to their senator.
And again, it's SJ Res 47.
Yes, SJ Res 47, and it's the CFPB arbitration rule. They'll definitely know what you're talking about.
Well, Amanda Werner, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Amanda Werner, who's the arbitration campaign manager with Americans for Financial Reform and Public Citizen, where she advocates strong consumer protection regulations. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing Trump's belated attention to Puerto Rico's plight after days of distracting the nation with a ginned-up controversy over football players kneeling during the national anthem.
They offer.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Luis Martinez Fernandez, who is a professor of history at the University of Central Florida. He is an historian of Latin America and the Caribbean, who focuses on the histories of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic. He was born in Cuba, graduated from a Puerto Rican university, and currently lives and teaches in Orlando, Florida, which has one of the world's highest concentrations of Puerto Ricans. Welcome to Background Briefing, Luis Martinez Fernandez.
Thank you, Ian.
And there have been a lot of criticism of President Trump, I believe, from Puerto Rico itself, but certainly in the press, that he's spending too much time criticizing or picking a fight with football players and not dealing with the American citizens in Puerto Rico who are in terrible shape, having been hit by two hurricanes, one after the other, and that the island is facing a massive humanitarian crisis. He did address that today in a press conference with the Prime Minister of Spain. However, he kept saying what great things that he's doing for the island. But that's not necessarily what I'm hearing. It's very hard to get through to the island. I did spend a lot of time on the phone today getting fragments of conversations. What are you hearing in terms of what's happening on the island itself in terms of meeting the humanitarian needs following this 1-2 punch of hurricanes?
Yes, there are different voices. On the one hand, Governor Rosselló is, I think, trying his best to present what the federal government is doing in the best light possible. Of course, he is the leader of the pro-statehood party and would be very hesitant, and particularly under the current circumstances, to be critical of the United States and the role that it is playing during this very, very severe crisis on the island. So the way I see it is mostly a public relations issue. Trump is not very good at that, of course, so so there's not much expectation in terms of soothing words from the White House. But on the other hand, today I listened to a report by FEMA in terms of everything that is being mobilized in support of the island's recovery at this juncture.
So the governor, of course, did thank former President George W. Bush and the former governor of Florida, Jeb Bush, but he pointedly hadn't thanked Donald Trump. So perhaps that led Donald Trump to have this press conference today. How much is this, though, a serious crisis? Because I've been reading lots of press suggesting that people simply aren't paying enough attention, that this is far worse than people realize, that these are fellow Americans in distress, that there's a dam about to burst in the northwest corner of the island. What's your picture, since you're in touch with a lot of friends and relatives in the island? What are you hearing, Luis?
Well, I'm hearing details about the gravity of the situation. I am a historian, and I have looked at the history of Puerto Rico from the beginning of its founding as a Spanish colony, and there hasn't been anything of this magnitude in terms of dramatic changes, not even the war between Spain and the United States in 1898, not even other political transformations. I believe that given what has transpired and the length of time that it will take for the situation to clear up, that this is going to be a big marker as far as periodization of the history of Puerto Rico. And we will talk about Puerto Rico before Maria and Puerto Rico after Maria. The calamity is of, as some have said, of apocalyptic proportions. And what aggravates this is that it's hard for people in the continental United States to visualize total destruction of an entire geographic unit. If we have a crisis in Florida, immediately we get support from Georgia and vice versa. When you are trapped in an island, a relatively small island, where the entirety of the territory has suffered, you can't count on that rapid type of response. Now, the political angle is very important. I've been listening to the latest polls, and more than half of U.S. citizens do not know that the people of Puerto Rico are citizens of the United States. Now, it's a combination, I think, of, on the one hand, ignorance of that fact, and then on the other hand, the fact that Puerto Rico and its people are not a priority for the United States at this time, and certainly politically, the atmosphere does not point to conditions that will be favorable as far as support for Puerto Rico.
Well, the tweets that Donald Trump put out certainly made people wonder about his sympathy for the plight of the people of Puerto Rico. He talked about how much money was owed to Wall Street and how the infrastructure and the grid had been neglected. It almost sounded like, you know, you're blaming the victim.
You're absolutely right. And as we all know, Puerto Rico, before the two hurricanes, had been going through its deepest crisis ever. I would liken it to the Great Depression. And then on top of that, we have this, and it's total destruction. So I don't know what's going to happen. As a historian, I'm just trying to wrap my mind around what is the future of Puerto Rico, and I don't see any possibilities of immediate recovery. Now, the attitude of the President of the United States, which does not surprise me given his track record and his treatment of people from other parts of the world, does not help. And I think this is going to have some major repercussions for Puerto Rico when people start thinking about politics and status politics again. This was a U.S. president that did not treat, at least as far as we've seen, the people of Puerto Rico, his fellow citizens, with the degree of respect and actually humanity that would be expected of a president or any other person, really.
So is this to say, then, that could this situation in Puerto Rico become Donald Trump's Katrina, which, of course, did adversely impact George W. Bush?
I would say that in terms of human pain and destruction of property, this is worse than Katrina for a number of reasons. I mean, we're talking about the totality of an island being destroyed. As far as the political ramifications, I don't think so. I think that very little is expected from Donald Trump. And if people had difficulties viewing Katrina and New Orleans as part of the United States, as a deserving part of the country, imagine what the situation is for Puerto Rico, which is distant, which is a different culture. It's not a state of the United States, so the political climate is not a positive one, I would say.
So in terms of the Puerto Rican population where you are in Orlando, my understanding is that people on the island have been reaching out, political leaders have been reaching out in frustration because they haven't been getting the attention they've needed. They've talked directly to the media. Are the Puerto Ricans in the diaspora being mobilized? What's your sense of how they see what's happening to the island?
Well, here in Orlando, the local Puerto Rican population has mobilized at different levels. On the one hand, there's the humanitarian effort to secure water, food, basic supplies to be sent to the island. But then at another level, and not just the Puerto Ricans, we've seen how people like Marco Rubio from Florida, people like Governor Cuomo from New York are also mobilizing in terms of congressional action to create a package of emergency relief for Puerto Rico.
Well, my understanding, Luis, is that one of the solutions to this problem will be a mass exodus of Puerto Ricans to the mainland. Is that likely to happen?
That is very likely to happen. If we look at what has happened in the last 2 years alone, without hurricanes, 80 or 90,000 Puerto Ricans have been coming to the United States, mainly to Central Florida, where we already have about 400,000 Puerto Ricans. In Florida, the whole state, there's a little over a million of Puerto Ricans. Now, what happens is that there's some very intimate connections between the island and the Puerto Rican population here in Florida. They continuously travel. Kids spend summers in Orlando or Puerto Rico. It's a very, very intimate connection. And people who are on the island and they've lost everything. They have no electricity, will not have it for months, may not have the resources to rebuild. It's very natural that we can expect to see them by the hundreds of thousands within the next 2 or 3 years. The exodus was also happening, was already happening. The exodus was increasing, and what we will see in the next few months is a massive migration, some temporary. While they are able to rebuild, others will stay here for the long run.
So in terms of this peculiar anachronism known as the Jones Act, which goes back to World War I, and it requires all cargo ships docking in Puerto Rican to carry U.S.-flagged vessels and an American crew. And apparently this has had the effect of making food, for example, in Puerto Rico much, much more expensive than it is there in Orlando, Florida, for example. So how are they going to waive the Jones Act to get the aid in? Do you know?
I'm not sure of what can be done. I would imagine that people in government and the administration would be creative enough to recognize that this is the time when aid, wherever it comes from, on whatever vessel it comes from, is absolutely essential. Again, I don't know the legal mechanisms of going around that, but if an island is sinking, then you can't wait for a distant vessel. You need the immediate support from neighbors.
So is it true then that the Jones Act has contributed to the economic problems of the island? I mean, Donald Trump, again, as I say, in his tweets, he talked about how they owe so much money to Wall Street and how their grid is terrible. He said it's sad, but that's not the same as, you know, pulling the stops out, helping the island, and maybe coming up with a way to make it more viable. So just on the Jones Act, does the Jones Act make life more expensive and consumer goods more expensive for Puerto Ricans?
Well, that is true. However, we need to see the Jones Act as a package that was granted to, some would say, imposed on Puerto Rico back in 1917, which, among other things, included citizenship for the people of Puerto Rico. I don't see how a discussion of the Jones Act that only looks at one aspect of that is really valuable at this point. Because on the other hand, the people of Puerto Rico, I should say, also receive certain benefits from the United States, and the fact that they are citizens of the United States entitles them to certain protections. So, again, I don't think we should look at the Jones Act and see it as a totality and judge it. I think it's important to keep in mind that with that citizenship also came some responsibilities.
Right, but Puerto Ricans don't have U.S. senators and they don't have Congress people. They have somebody that sits in the Congress but has no influence and can't vote. So when you say they were given citizenship, it was citizenship with limitations.
Of course. Puerto Rico did not cease to be a colony in 1917. It did not cease to be a colony in 1952 when it was granted increased autonomy. And if anything is clear in the last 10 years or so, is that the advantages of Puerto Rico's status as a commonwealth are being tested. And we see that, for example, Puerto Rico does not have the right that other jurisdictions in the United States would have to declare bankruptcy, for example. So it's very evident that the Jones Act and the current status in general is not the best of circumstances. Now, as a historian, I like to think about options, and what are the options? Independence? I don't think so. I would much rather be in an island going through this crisis that has at least the support of the United States and the responsibility of the United States than being in an island like the Dominican Republic, which cannot count on that kind of support. So it's really a balance of advantages and disadvantages that the island is currently facing.
But in terms of Donald Trump's visit now, he says he's going down there on Tuesday. What do you expect from that? Obviously, when you see the footage you see, and it's very hard, as I say, I spent hours today on the phone talking to people in Puerto Rico, and you can only hear every other 10th word, and I have to keep calling back all the time. So just based on my experience today, it's pretty frustrating to communicate. So if the electricity is down, the cell towers are down, you have no drinking water, you're not going to have electricity for a whole month. I'd say this is a real crisis.
It is a profound crisis. I think we will not have electricity on the island for many, many months. When you look at an island where 85% of the cables that conduct electricity have fallen and are in disrepair, just think about that, the physical effort of crews of individuals, first of all, cleaning the debris, then setting aside all of the trash, and then beginning to import the light posts that will be needed on the island. It's just unimaginable, really, what it will take for that island to recover.
So, but let's get to the politics of why it is that Puerto Rico has stayed in this limbo, and this political limbo. My reading on it is that essentially the Republicans don't want to grant statehood and voting power because that would mean, most likely, since Puerto Ricans tend to vote Democrat, that you'd have two Democratic senators and a Democratic congressperson or even more. Is that what's behind this, keeping Puerto Rico in a colonial state?
Well, that's one of the factors. As you say, Puerto Ricans would vote Democratic, and they would have two Democratic senators, and they would have five or six Democratic congresspeople. That's something that the Republicans would not welcome. So we can also think about what happened in Hawaii, right? Conservatives did not want Hawaii to join the Union when it did, precisely because they feared that it would be a liberal state. So I don't see much energy on either party, really, to welcome Puerto Rico as a state. The argument would be the people of Puerto Rico need to make up their minds. And if we look at electoral results over the last 20, 25 years, Puerto Ricans are split on whether they would like to be a state of the United States or remain in a sort of, as you use the term, limbo status, where it's neither a state or nor an independent country.
Well, Luis Martinez Fernandez, let's stay in touch. Obviously, the agony of the Puerto Rican people on this ravaged island will go on for a long time. You think it'll be months and months before they get electricity back. So let's stay in touch, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Luis Martinez Fernandez, who is a professor of history at the University of Central Florida. He is an historian of Latin America and the Caribbean, who focuses on the histories of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic. And he was born in Cuba, graduated from a Puerto Rican university, and currently lives and teaches in Orlando, Florida, which has one of the world's highest concentrations of Puerto Ricans. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back assessing the impact of Monday's non-binding independence referendum in Iraqi Kurdistan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Edmund Garib, who is an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds and Iraq. He was the first Mustafa Barzani Scholar of Global Kurdish Studies at the Center for Global Peace at American University, and formerly was a professor at Georgetown University, George Washington University, and the University of Virginia. And his books include The Kurdish Question in Iraq, The Kurdish Nationalist Movement, and War in the Gulf, which he co-authored with Majid Kaduri. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edmund Garib.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you, Edmund. And at this point, the results are not in, but the assumption isn't. But the assumption surely is, Edmund, that there will be an overwhelming yes vote.
Yes, I would say that generally speaking, that's what's expected. Personally, I was expecting that it would be somewhere around 75% of the voters supporting independence. But as of now, we don't yet have the official figures for the results of the vote. Nevertheless, there have been reports that the percentage of is about 72.16.
And there was a lot of warnings from Turkey and from the government in Baghdad of Iraq. So what do you make of the independence referendum?
Well, clearly this was a very important and historic event for the Kurds particularly, but also for some of their neighbors. Of course, a great deal will depend on what happens next. Are we likely to see any moves towards independence anytime soon? That's the question. I doubt that's what's going to happen. Primarily, this referendum is not binding. And at the same time, it does not have any timeline to trigger actions or steps, taking steps toward independence. So this may offer a way to between Iraq and the central government and the Kurdish regional government to communicate, to try to enter into a serious dialogue, to resolve the problems between them. And ultimately, this may either end with some kind of independence. It's one thing if you have independence and agreed upon by the two parties, the two partners, or it could, if it's violent, that's a different story. The second thing is if it does happen, then that is going to create a great deal of conflict, a great deal of tension in the region. And as we spoke the last time, the main problem is, as you know, it's not just the Kurds of Iraq. The neighbors of Iraq have already expressed strong opposition to the referendum. Basically, Turkey and Iran, because Turkey has the largest Kurdish population in the Middle East, has somewhere between 20 to 22, maybe even a higher number of Kurds. Iran also has somewhere between 10 to 11 million Kurds, and that they see this move toward independence, or at least the referendum, as a step towards independence and separation, and that means a threat to their internal security, to their territorial integrity. So we have here a real conflict between two different positions. You have the Kurds, who have for a long time dreamed of independence, dreamed of self-determination. They were denied that right after the Allies, after First World War, promised them self-determination, if that's what they wanted, and if they proved that they are capable of running their own territory, their own affairs. But with the changes in Turkey and the coming of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, there was a new agreement with the Allies, the Lausanne Treaty, which didn't mention a single word about Kurdish self-determination. So as you know, there have been numerous uprisings in the different countries towards some kind of self-rule, federalism, or independence. But so far, they all failed. Now, I think there is a new chance, a new opportunity that perhaps to reach some kind of an accord. If the Kurdish leadership views the referendum simply as a step toward independence, I see a great deal of tension, conflict coming down the road. If it sees it, however, as a step towards to strengthen the cards it holds in its hand in its negotiations with Baghdad, either to remain and have perhaps a more, a stronger or a self-rule arrangement, perhaps a confederal state, that might be one thing. But if it is a move towards independence, then I expect we're going to see a great deal of tension and conflict.
So when you have Turkey's Prime Minister Erdogan saying that he might impose new sanctions to persuade the Barzani government to give up on this adventure that can only have a dark end. And we know that there's considerable trade with the Kurdistan region and Turkey. We also know that Iraqi soldiers have joined with Turkish troops in military exercises just in the same area, just across the border. So that would be a pretty clear signal of displeasure,
clearly,
isn't it?
Clearly, it's an ominous sign, as you're saying. It's a basically, Turkey and Iraq were not on the best of terms. Turkey has, in the past, claimed Mosul, claimed parts of Iraq. It had also claimed to be the guarantor, the protector of the Turkmen. And this is another issue that is likely to erupt as a very serious source of conflict. Is, as you know, there are basically the three provinces in northern Iraq which had been granted self-rule. Basically, it didn't start recently. In fact, it goes back all the way to 1970 when, under the Ba'ath government and under the leadership of Mullah Mustafa Barzani, who is the leader of was the leader of the Kurds at that time and the father of the current president, Masoud Barzani, they reached an agreement allowing three Kurdish provinces, majority Kurdish provinces, to have self-rule. But there were differences, and one of the differences then as now is the conflict over Kirkuk. Kirkuk is a diverse city. It has many populations. It has Turkmen, it has Arabs, it has Kurds, it has Christians of different denominations. And historically, this has been a very important issue because Kirkuk is also oil rich, and both sides claim it. And so as a result, Turkey here has often claimed that it's the protector of the Turkmen, who are a Turkic people close to the Turks, and would defend them. So basically, you have these areas which are disputed territories between the central government and the Kurdish regional government. And these are issues that are likely to trigger a great deal of conflict because there is going to be a fight over water, over borders, over oil and gas. And so as a result of this, we're likely to see a great deal of tension unless there is a new effort, a more serious, genuine effort by Baghdad and Erbil to try to reach some kind of agreement on these issues in order to avoid a much worse conflict than we have seen in recent times.
Well, the Peshmerga, the Kurdish fighters, the military, have been the only boots on the ground that the U.S. has learned that they can rely on to fight and dislodge the Islamic State, or Daesh, both in Iraq and in Syria. And it's pretty clear, particularly in Syria, that this, the very prominence of the Peshmerga, really upset Erdogan. And that many people think that he wants to have all those refugees in his country, basically, you know, ethnically cleanse the Kurds out of that strip along the southern border, which then links up with Iraqi Kurdistan. And if I were a Kurd, I'd be nervous that President Trump seems to be pretty blind to Erdogan's authoritarian tendencies. He may well even admire him. He referred to him as a good friend the other day, and the very day that again, Erdogan's bodyguards beat the hell out of American citizens, demonstrators, as they did earlier in an earlier visit. So what's your sense of Trump's attitude towards the Kurds, if in fact there is something?
Well, we haven't heard much, actually, from President Trump. During the election campaign, he did make a few statements, few words, where he praised the Kurds as fighters against ISIS. But we haven't heard much recently, at least from the president himself. Although today, for example, he was asked and made some references to what's happening in Catalonia, where you have a movement that's trying to separate from Spain. But the journalists didn't ask him, and he didn't say anything about what's happening in Kurdistan. But however, we can get a sense of what the president, where he is today, or at least from some of the statements that have come from spokespeople for the White House and the State Department. Perhaps one of the most important was the one that came out yesterday by the spokeswoman from the State Department. And basically, she expressed disappointment that the Kurdish regional government decided to conduct what it called unilateral referendum on independence. And basically, also it added that this was included the areas outside the Iraqi Kurdistan region. At the same time, they said that the statement said that the United States' historical relationship with the people of the Kurdish region will not change in light of today's non-binding referendum. But they said that this will increase instability and hardship for the Kurdish region and its people. So basically, they're emphasizing the fact that this is a unilateral referendum and that it's likely to complicate the relationship with both the government of Iraq and the neighboring countries. And also, they're warning that this could bring hardships to the people of the Kurdish region. So basically, the United States appears to be taking into account the concerns and the interests of some of the neighbors, particularly here I'm speaking about Turkey. Turkey is an important ally for the United States. That's the way it's viewed. It's a member of NATO, although there have been a lot of tensions in recent times between the two sides. Nevertheless, the U.S. still values that special relationship with Turkey, particularly because of its geostrategic significance. And so there is a question here. How is the U.S. going to go forward? Are we likely to see a new effort by the United States to try to help the central government in Baghdad and Erbil to try to reach an agreement among themselves and at the same time to make sure to help to put pressure on the neighbors not to interfere in the internal affairs of Iraq, to allow the Iraqi parties to reach an agreement? This may be the best way, first of all, to reach a just arrangement and also to avoid further conflict and violence.
Well, one of the things that got our attention was, of course, the fact that Paul Manafort, who's tied up in the Russia scandal, was a consultant, I guess. Was he a consultant to Barzani? But he was somehow involved in this referendum.
He was also a consultant to a businessman who was close to the Turkish government. He did some lobbying, I guess.
Right.
And he wrote an article before the election about this this relationship or this issue.
Right.
Particularly about the Islamic leader who is accused by the Turkish government, Fethullah Gulen, of being behind the coup last year in Turkey.
Well, just in closing then, the referendum basically said yes or no to the question, do you want the Kurdistan region and the Kurdistani areas outside the Kurdistan region to become an independent country? So I imagine the second part of that is what's got the Turks.
I think that's an important point that you just made.
Yeah.
I think there, I've talked to a number of Iraqi Arabs. There are many who oppose any kind of independence for the Kurds, but I've also talked with some who say they would favor independence if the Kurds, first of all, reach an agreement with Baghdad, and secondly, if it's, they do not include the disputed areas as part of the Kurdish region. They said, these areas are basically made up of many different ethnic and religious communities, and they are not Kurdish historically, and therefore these should remain outside. And then if the Kurds want to go on their own way towards independence in the three provinces of Duhok, Erbil, and Sulaymaniyya, then that's great. That's fine.
Well, Edmund Garib, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Edmund Garib, who's an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds in Iraq. He was the first Mustafa Barzani Scholar of Global Kurdish Studies at the Center for Global Peace at American University and formerly professor at Georgetown University, George Washington University, and the University of Virginia. And his books include The Kurdish Question in Iraq and The Kurdish Nationalist Movement. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.